I got a letter from old George W. It said, son, I hate to trouble you, but this war of mine is going bad. It's time for me to roll those dice. I know you've already been there twice, but I am sending you back to Baghdad. George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation. This is just a surge toward victory. Just to win my little war, I'm sending 20,000 more to help me save Iraq from Iraqis. And so I made it to Iraq in time for one more sneak attack. Into my old battalion I was sent. We'd drive around in our Humvees, listening to the Black Eyed Peas and speaking fondly of our president. George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation, this is just a surge toward victory. Just to win my little war, I'm sending 20,000 more to help me save Iraq from Iraqis. Celebrities all come to see us, grateful they don't have to be us. Politicians play their best face card. Where is Bubba? Where's our leader? Where's our favorite lip reader? AWOL from the Texas National Guard. George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation, this is just a surge toward victory. Just to win my little war, I'm sending 20,000 more to help me save Iraq from Iraqis. If you're hunkered in Fallujah, wondering who it was who screwed you, wondering what became of shock and awe, you are feeling semi-certain it has to do with Halliburton, Dick Cheney's why you drew that fatal straw. But George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation, this is just a surge toward victory. Just to win my little war, I'm sending 20,000 more to help me save Iraq from Iraqis.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to Scott Atran being interviewed by Chris Mooney. Scott Atran is an anthropologist and leading expert on terrorism and violent extremism.
I think perhaps never in history have so few armed with so few means caused so much fear in so many. It's like the anarchists a century ago. It's precisely the outsized reaction that sponsors of terrorism have always used to terrorize.
So how do you reverse that? Because it, to me, it's kind of like great white sharks, you know? I mean, very few people die from a great white shark attack, but great white sharks are so scary that they get incredibly dramatized. And so we get incredibly afraid of the water. I mean, and it's the same thing with a terrorist attack. It's so scary that it gets, it reverberates.
Yeah. Well, you know, Henry Ford used to call this the jerk effect. You know, when you hit a pothole for the first time, you get really all, you know, you're surprised, you get all excited, blood rushes, and you start being very wary about potholes everywhere. But then it should die down, right? Even if it was a massive attack, you can't expect a massive attack every time. And I think it's all, I mean, look at the difference between, say, the reaction even to Pearl Harbor in World War II compared to this. I mean, that certainly was a much more momentous event. It mobilized the entire world and the entire nation and everything about it. And it really was a world historical struggle where the outcome wasn't decided by any means in advance. Okay, so Edward R. Murrow, a veteran journalist, he's at the White House, and he hears of the attack. And first thing he does is says, I can't report this until the administration knows what's going on and has a plan to address the American people. I mean, no one would do that in this country. You have a scoop. It's a 24-hour news cycle. In fact, if you actually look at news stories between 1950s, when Edward R. Murrow was reporting for CBS, say, and now, you find that the average news story length has shrunk from about 2 minutes and 40 seconds to 8 to 15 seconds in soundbite. And these are repeated soundbites. And so you've got sort of nonsense stories. It's the same things repeated all on over and over again. And they sensationalize the spectacular. And, of course, violence privileges that, because nothing's more sensational than violence except perhaps sex or violence and sex. And then there's this, you know, frenetic, hyperkinetic competition for sensationalism, and the politicians who have to respond to the media, because that's the way they get their message, both from the people and to the people, they buy into it. And so this rather marginal phenomena certainly never threatens United States infrastructure, economy, or the society in any really sincere way, but of course our reaction does. So how do you stop it? Well, you've got to stop the hysteria. So now here's the problem. This is an open society. An open society, especially under the First Amendment, the free press is supposed to act as the Republic's watchdog, which it's not really doing, to prevent government excesses and abuses so a well-informed public can monitor and decide where government policies should go. So censorship, constitutionally, and because of the history of our people, it just isn't going to work. I mean, they try it in Europe, it backfires. I mean, they're a little more successful because notions of the free press are a little less embedded in history, and also because they're a little less concerned with money in terms of the businesses involved in the press. You know, this frenetic competition. But you know, some self restraint would be in order. Now, the newspapers used to do that. The great newspapers, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, even the Wall Street Journal, the St. Louis Dispatch, the Sun, Baltimore Sun, all these papers would practice this kind of self-restraint. Not even a gentle censorship, but really self-restraint, you know, because they thought of themselves as reporting for the social good. But that's not the case anymore. I mean, even if they would like to report themselves for the social good, they're now in competition with people who can care less about the social good.
Yeah, but you also have, I mean, a lot of this is not even media. A lot of this is social media. I mean, I got news about most of my information from Twitter. Of course, it was mostly wrong, right? Or a lot of it was wrong in the immediate first 10, 15 minutes. So I knew extremely fast, and everybody was talking. I mean, there's no self-restraint on there. Even if major media were doing self-restraint, you'd still have this flood of social media pictures and comments. Oh my God, just heard an explosion.
Yeah, but then the media and the politicians can say, well, hold off, guys. Let's, you know, here we've got a lot of noise. Let's see what the message is here. And let's not, you know, overreact. Like CNN posts a guy who, you know, accuses the wrong people, headlines scream, you know, 12-man terror cell. I mean, even a few years ago when we were doing studies of suicide bombing for the U.S. government, we found that newspaper articles and stories and television art, especially television press, got between 30 to 50% of their facts wrong, and even the names of the people involved misidentified. So when we were doing data analysis, what made our stuff a little better than most was that we just ignored everything written for the first 6 months. And then we, you know, we actually went through things like court transcripts where you do trial is, cross-examination trial is very much like peer review, and you can filter the information. Now, you can't do that in the beginning. The public demands a reaction. But again, the reaction the public demands is stoked by the sort of hysterical reaction that's reported and out there. And the job of politicians and the media should be, you know, to help the people.
Well, let me just clarify, because I think this may be controversial. Are you also saying that this, what you're calling the hysterical reaction, does that fire up, are you arguing that fires up terrorists? I mean, do they want publicity, or do they want to kill people?
They want publicity. I mean, publicity is the oxygen of terrorism. Look, these are mostly young men for whom mortal combat and the band of brothers in the service of a great cause provides the ultimate adventure and maximum esteem, especially in the eyes of their peers. And so for many of these disaffected guys, jihad's a heroic cause that holds promise that anyone from anywhere in the world can make a mark against the most powerful country in the history of the world. But because these guys thrive and act in small groups and among networks of family and friends, not in large movements or armies, their threat can only match their ambitions if it's fueled way beyond actual strength by publicity, which is the oxygen of terrorism. So, like nations, they avoid publicizing killing, well, whether it's ethnic cleansing or even collateral deaths from drones. But the whole purpose of terrorism is to be spectacular and have an act, which even fails, by the way, which can even fail, amplified all out of proportion by the media and the hysterical reaction of the politicians. I mean, God, for God's sake, there was a global security alert in 190 countries after this thing. I mean, even after Faisal Shahzad Fizzlefan, where the guy is such, you know, basically such a moron that he tried to ignite a gas canister with a firecracker, there was a national alert. The whole country was put on national alert, military and civilian. I mean, this is really crazy. And in fact, that is what makes terrorism terrorism. We help terrorists terrorize. And if we could show restraint, to the extent that we show restraint, okay, and let people simply go on with their lives and show people carrying on with their lives, then terrorism, in whatever form, can never succeed and probably fade away.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Coming up next, from the movie All Quiet on the Western Front, Paul Boehmer addresses Professor Cantorek's class on the harsh realities of war.
I can't tell you anything you don't know. We live in the trenches out there. Fight. We try not to be killed. Sometimes we are. That's all.
No. No, Paul.
I've been there. I know what it's like.
That's not what one dwells on, Paul.
I heard you in here reciting that same old stuff, making more Iron Men, more young heroes. You still think it's beautiful and sweet to die for your country, don't you? We used to think you knew. The first bombardment taught us better. It's dirty and painful to die for your country. When it comes to dying for your country, it's better not to die at all. There are millions out there dying for their country. What good is it?
Paul!
You ask me to tell them how much they're needed out there? He tells you, go out and die. Oh, but if you'll pardon me, it's easier to say go out and die than it is to do it.
Coward!
And it's easier to say it than to watch it happen.
You're a coward! You're a coward! No, boy! I'm sorry, Dalma, but I must say...
No use talking like this. You won't know what I mean. Only, it's been a long while since we enlisted out of this classroom. So long, I thought maybe the whole world had learned by this time. Only now they're sending babies. And they won't last a week. I shouldn't have come on leave. Up at the front, you're alive or you're dead, and that's all. You can't fool anybody about that very long. And up there, we know we're lost and done for, whether we're dead or alive. 3 years we've had of it. 4 years. And every day a year, and every night a century. And our bodies are earth, and our thoughts are clay. And we sleep and eat with death. We're done for because you can't live that way and keep anything inside you. I shouldn't have come on leave. I'll go back tomorrow. I've got 4 days more, but I can't stand it here. I'll go back tomorrow. Sorry.
Well, let me just shift it in one more direction. The question of the influence, and this is another controversial direction, the question of the influence of Islam. I mean, and this is, you know, if you're in secular humanism, new atheist circles, there's been another giant flare-up of this. People have accused Sam Harris of actually being Islamophobic, which he strongly rejects. And he says back, no, look, I mean, the obvious fact of the world is that, you know, you can't criticize Islam or you get attacked, whereas you can criticize other, you know, you could never have a Broadway play making fun of Islam like you have a Broadway play making fun of Mormonism right now. He says there's something about it in the world today that is more violent. That's his contention. And, you know, here we have these, the latest attackers. Again, it is Islam. So what is your take on that?
God, that's such a complex and confused issue. First of all, religions are fairly neutral vessels. They can be used for good or bad. I mean, they have no sort of fixed propositions, and you can interpret them almost anything you want. I mean, there are no truths or falsehoods, really. There's just what you make of it. And that's why we have, you know, weekly sermons. And that's why they survive over centuries, because if they did have fixed propositions, you know, it certainly collapsed faster than scientific traditions, which collapse pretty fast because they're sort of falsified. So, you know, they're frameworks, they're moral frameworks that provide sort of a transcendental moral foundation for large groups coalescing. I mean, how else do you get genetic relatives to form large cooperative groups? It doesn't have to necessarily today be religious, but, you know, it involves transcendental ideas. Take human rights, for example. That's a crazy idea. You know, 250 years ago, a bunch of intellectuals in Europe decided that providence or nature made all human beings equal, endowed by the Creator with, you know, rights to liberty and happiness. When the history of 200,000 years of human life had been mostly cannibalism, infanticide, murder, suppression of minorities and women. And so through wars and social engineering, they took this crackpot idea and made it real. But in general, societies that have, you know, sort of unfalsifiable and unverifiable transcendental conceptions win out over those that don't. I mean, Darwin talked about it as moral virtue and said that, you know, this is responsible for the kind of patriotism, sympathy, and loyalty that makes certain tribes win out over other tribes in this spiraling competition for dominance and survival. And again, without these transcendental ideas, we can't really people can't really be blinded to exit strategies. I mean, societies that are based on social contracts, no matter how good they are, the idea that there's always a better deal down the line makes them liable to collapse, while these societies are much less prone to that. And there are all sorts of other things associated with these sort of unverifiable propositions. So now the propositions of these things themselves can be interpreted, however, depending upon the political and social climate of the age. Islam has been interpreted in ways that were extremely progressive at one time, and at least parts of it are extremely retrogressive, especially as concerns science, for example, or the position of women in the world. Especially parts of it in many countries, it's extremely retrograde. But Islam itself, I mean, does it have some essence that, you know, encourages this kind of crazy violence? No, not at all. That, you know, that truly is absurd and just false. I mean, if you look at the history of Christianity or Judaism or any of these other religions or even non-religions like communism or fascism, you find the same sorts of things. Now, is it the case that Islam today, something special about the interpretation of Islam today? Well, yeah. I mean, just like white supremacist movements interpret a variant of fundamental Christian identity in crackpot ways, so do these guys. And that's dangerous. Now, the difference is that Western democracies and even Western non-democracies like Russia, their political structure is dominant with respect to others in their in the world or in their geopolitical region. And so, and the societies, these dominant societies, are advancing pretty well. To the extent that they're not advancing and there's no real possibility of expression, political expression, or economic advancement, then, you know, people with frustrated aspiration buy into whatever, you know, transcendental motive significance is around that they can give them a story, a narrative about what they should do with their lives and what others should do with their lives to make things better. Now, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, you've have one sort of really dominant narrative out there. That's, you know, democratic liberalism, as George Bush said in the reaction to 9/11 and the National Security Doctrine. There's only one way of life, right and true for every person in every society. You know, and Ahmadinejad says exactly the same thing about Islam, his version of Islam, as a sort of counter culture. And so, you know, frustrated guys, more and more marginalized guys, they hook up with this counterculture and see a way of empowering them and giving them significance and possibility where previously there was none. And Islam, the fact that Islamic countries for so long have been sort of in the dustbin of history and disadvantaged in so many ways, not necessarily by explicit policies of the West, but by their own internal dynamics, they've become stagnant and retrogressive. And so the young people take those aspects of Islam that they think can advance them. And the jihadi way, the path, the jihad, violent jihad, is one way. And they've seen it's being extraordinarily successful by the reaction of the United States. Again, take 9/11, cost $400,000. Well, between $400,000 and $500,000, depending on the... we've spent in reaction to this before Boston, about $4 trillion. Well, you know, that's pretty good cost benefit for the terrorists. And so the message is out there, you know, you too, with box cutters, or, you know, if needed, a pipe bomb, can change the world. Go ahead. But again, I don't see anything about Islam itself. You need some kind of transcendental ideal to get people to sacrifice for genetic strangers, for these larger groups. Religions are the best thing human history has come up with, but there are other competing transcendental notions of which, say, democratic liberalism, human rights, communism, fascism are others. And right now, the democratic liberal human rights thing is predominant over a large part of the world. And it's a salvational ideology. And the people who don't want that or who feel left, you know, in the driftwood of globalization, they are looking for something else to give them equal power and significance.
No, I have to ask that question because I know it's on a lot of people's minds.
You know, I was in Cairo talking to the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood a couple months ago. And, you know, I thought, you know, that, okay, the Muslim Brotherhood, da da da, they have to be monitored. You know, those guys are out to lunch too. I mean, they want nukes. When I was asking Sheikh Hagazi, who's the Secretary General of the Egyptian Revolutionary Council, and the guy who actually, with Mohammed Badawi, the Murshid, the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, appointed Morsi as a candidate for presidency. He's also the head of the World Council of Sunni Scholars. And he told me, he was explaining to me why Egypt needs nuclear weapons. It has nothing to do with Iran. They needed to counterbalance the power of Israel and America so that there's a level playing field. And once there's a level political playing field, then Islam must naturally win the hearts of the entire world, and the game is over, and we'll all be in Jerusalem. I mean, he really believes this. Now, the difference between, say, Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood is that all political groups, sort of Max Weber had this insight, all political groups, you know, have to manage both the values which make them forces for political change and the responsibilities of governance, such as providing economic security and physical security for their people. Well, along the spectrum, groups like Al-Qaeda are simply values-driven. I mean, they don't care what they sacrifice, who they sacrifice, when they sacrifice. Everything has to be done now, and they are completely value-driven. But groups like the Muslim Brotherhood really do try to, you know, take care of their people. They have responsibilities of governance. Now, the hope is, as with Hezbollah, these kinds of groups can can, their true north, their values can be shifted over time. But I'm finding that, you know, they're pretty cagey guys in terms of being able to temporize, delay, yet not give up one bit of what they consider to be their final aim. I mean, after all, they suffered 80 years of persecution, killings, imprisonment. Now they're in power and they're trying to realize their goals. They're much more savvy than most other groups and do it. But that particular vein of Islam represented by the Muslim Brotherhood, which is part of the, you know, post-colonial reaction, I think is dangerous. I think it's not as dangerous as Al-Qaeda, precisely because by the very fact that they have to take responsibility for their people and meet economic necessities, they're subject to influence and even change, although I don't know how much change. But the groups like Al-Qaeda, no, forget it. I mean, they literally have to be either fought to the death or contained, isolated, marginalized in ways that, you know, they can't hurt us. But allowing them, I mean, publicizing the you know, Al-Qaeda is a movement, Alan, publicizing, amplifying by a thousandfold, by a millionfold, their acts only makes them stronger. Bin Laden must be turning over in his grave like a lathe.
Well, let me just ask you one final question here, because you've really raised, I think, a very difficult point of how much attention we pay to attacks like the ones in Boston. So is anybody, but yet it's such a hard question to address because of everybody's instinct in the media and the political system. So is anybody taking this message besides you, or is it trickling up? I mean, you know, or...
I know, a lot of people understand it, but the dynamical political and social and economic forces, well, political and economic forces in our country it would make instant wide-ranging gun control look like a game of hopscotch. I was with a group of FBI guys and CIA guys and intel guys from all over the world in a meeting in the parliament in the United Kingdom, and a deputy director of the FBI was there, and I said, like, are you kidding? I mean, people keep talking about these cells, there's this mass hysteria. He says, yeah, I know. We were talking about, by the way, the Torrance case of a former Black Panther and a gang member who teamed up in a cell and decided to become jihadis. And when one of them got out, he got a couple of friends, one immigrant, one son of a professor, and they robbed the gas station and they dropped the cell phone. And when the police picked up the cell phone, you know, they were robbing the gas station to do jihad. They had a crackpot scheme to hijack a plane to Mecca, to blow up the Israeli planes and embassy. Well, you know, instead of it just taking it as a sort of, you know, robbing a gas station, you know, two losers fail to really rob a gas station and drop their cell phone and have some crazy idea. They pulled 500 FBI agents. They pulled them off of St. Louis. They let all other cases drop to track down these two losers. And in fact, Mueller, the director of the FBI, said, you know, one of the reasons for the economic meltdown is that we had to put so many people on these, you know, a lot of times entrapment cases because, you know, the people were demanding action, that we lost the ball on white collar crime, which was much more devastating to the American people and to the world. They understand it. Mm-hmm. You know, the FBI, the heads of the FBI, say counterterrorism guys they work with in the White House. And now, in fact, they even have a company with those guys. They understand it. But again, the political and economic forces are such, and the collusion between the media and the politicians, sort of frenzied, overwrought, neurotic relationship, makes any change difficult.
Well, I'm glad we have given you a chance to air this, because it's of all the, and there's been so much attention, right? And so many people offering so many opinions. Let me honestly say that I don't think many people are offering that opinion, but it seems very important and very valid and well-reasoned. So I'm glad that this show has actually come to be a place where we can get that out there. So, Scott, thanks so much for being with us again on Point of Inquiry.
Bye, Chris.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool. And he never gives an answer, but the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. Well, on the way, head in a cloud, the man of a thousand voices talking perfectly loud. But nobody ever hears him or the sound he appears to make. And he never seems to notice. But the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. And nobody seems to like him. They can tell what he wants to do, and he never shows his feelings. But the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.